This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 332 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So this is a new thing for us. So last week, Summer was not here with us for the live after show. And we probably won't be here again this week for the live after show. We're still figuring that out. We do have a backup for recording, thankfully. We had one last episode, but we're trying something else because we think it'll be better. It does not rely on Wi-Fi, which is why you got some like little humming and different things last week. This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Linda Z. And we will talk more about what a co-producer is and how you can look into that and everything at the end of the episode. So Summer, take us into what we're doing.
Let us get on to our episode discussion of episode 307, entitled The Ballad of Roger Mack.
Did the title strike any, like, sound like anything else to you? Like, have you heard of something like that before?
Well, when you hear, like, folk tales or folk songs that are like the ballad of so-and-so, it's usually their last meeting on Earth. It's usually how they sing about somebody who's just died.
Ah, yes.
Usually.
Yes.
In my recollection.
Now, I can't speak to that as far as what I'm about to say, meaning because I haven't listened to the whole thing or read the whole thing. I don't know the whole story. But when I heard the title is The Ballad of Roger Mack, just because of the way the syllables fall, well, Roger Mack, yeah, it's the same exact syllabism. I don't know what you call it. Same exact verbal rhythm, I guess, word rhythm. There's an opera, and I think it's a one act, though I could be wrong, called The Ballad of Baby Doe. And so when I heard The Ballad of Roger Mack, I thought, ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba, because it has the same exact
well
meter.
Yes, but also remember, when you think about it, when you hear people in the olden days, and they're like, and they have minstrels, and they're always like, I'll come along and I'll sing of all of your fair deeds.
Yes, and as soon as you say minstrel, I think of periods.
No, not menstrual. Minstrels.
I know.
Like Witcher, the dude that followed him around and sang of his glory. Usually, they're not, when they're done singing of their glory, it's because they died.
Once it gets started, in the previously on Outlander, we're reminded of the Isaiah Morton little storyline, Bonnet and the smallpox on the ship.
I kept trying to call him Nathaniel.
Nathaniel Morton?
Yeah, I know that's not his name, but as I was taking my notes, I was like, wait, what's his name? And I kept writing Nathaniel, and I was like, I know that's not right. And then when I got to the end, I had to go back and change all my Nathaniels to Isaiah's.
And don't forget Bonnet and the smallpox on the ship, and how Roger helped save Morag, and or at least the baby. And we're reminded of all the shenanigans that started this, at least in this season, in Hillsborough.
Yes.
Then we get the intro, which is what I call the music part. Now, I have to ask you, and I could be wrong, and I didn't go through scene by scene, but I just realized after we both remarked before that we had last episode, you had mentioned, or both of us had, but I think you said the words in the intro, you said, we got so many. Last episode, we found out what so many of those scenes were or shots were in the intro. And we got a number of them this episode. I don't think as many as last episode. But
we got the main one, which is Jamie from the back.
Yes. And I think we've seen everything. And I didn't go through and make a note of every single one. But the ones that stand out are the tarot card of the Hanged Man. We haven't seen that yet. Which is kind of funny now that it's done, because the whole point of it was to have it before, but I guess they're going to bring it in somehow. We haven't seen that. And this is the one I might be wrong on. We haven't seen them. We've seen her with the microscope, right? I don't know that we've seen the microscope with that little scene where it's, you know, the mirror moves and the sun shines in it, or the light does. Maybe we did. But I know we haven't gotten the buffalo. So basically the buffalo and the Hanged Man are kind of what's left. Did I miss anything?
Technically, we didn't get the shot of the feet dragging to the tents. I think that it was implied that those were the Murta feet being dragged.
Oh, no, not Murta. That was Isaiah Morton.
Oh, those were his feet?
Yeah. That we did get. I forgot that. We did get.
I didn't even see that. Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, that's all. That's all I have for the intro. And then in the opening title, we get, which makes perfect sense given the title of the episode, we have Roger with a guitar, again, headless. We're always headless unless, and if there is a head, it's covered up like last week with, you know, like that powder cover, right? So you don't get powder in your face. We get Roger with a guitar, and obviously he's back in Oxford or in Scotland, and he's composing something. And you know, at the top of the line, at the top of the sheet music or sheet page of sheet music, which is mostly blank, it says the Ballad of Roger Mac. So given the timing, obviously not 18th century, given the timing and given the, not necessarily the music, but given the title and the timing of that, meaning it's not 17th century. I don't know that he wrote that before they left.
Oh, I'm sure he didn't. But I'm thinking that what you need to do, Ginger, is you need to pause that and sing or play the music. What the tune is of the Ballad of Roger Mac.
I paused it and I did play it. And it has no time signature.
Of course you did.
There's no time signature. And there's no key signature. So typically with a piece of...
Well, then you just have to assume it's in C. Well,
either C or A minor. And with the number of A's it keeps going back to, I'm guessing it's A minor. My first thought was, oh, I wonder if Bear had any say in this. Because the problem... That's not the problem. But really without... The key signature, you can also, like Summer said, your first guess is either A minor or C major, which is fine. Okay, that's not necessarily incorrect because obviously if it is A minor or C major, we do have a key signature, right? Because the key signature is nothing. It's blank. But we have no time signature. Most of the measures seem to be 3/4, but one of them has like a dotted quarter and more. It just looks like it's too much for the measure, like it's too heavy, right? And we're not getting mixed measures or mixed signatures because we got nothing there. So anyway, if I say, okay, let that part go, that's why I don't think that Bear had any say in this.
Well, I mean, I feel like that's just the rudimentary. I'm writing a song. Nobody starts with key signatures.
No, but you know.
Tempos. They're just like, I want to get the notes out. I think that he would put the measures and bars in later once he's done getting all the tune down. I think what he's in the preliminary tune part.
He already put the bars in. The bars are there. If the bars are there, then that means you have a time signature. He's just not keeping to it. So let me go. What I can do, I don't know if you won't be able to hear it. Okay, I'll hum it to you and I'll take it out. Okay, ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it sounds like this. Da 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 da. And it ends on an A. Da, da. It's dancing all around the A, so it has to be A minor. And it doesn't sound very major, does it? But yeah.
Okay, so the next thing we have to do is we have to come up with lyrics.
Uh-oh.
For the Ballad of Roger Mac.
Oh, Summer.
That go with that. And we can't do it right now, but that could be our project, is to come up with lyrics for the rhythm so we can have our own Ballad of Roger Mac. If I write it, it's going to sound like Weird Al Yankovic wrote it because I am irreverent AF.
Okay, let me try and do it in time. It's in 3/4 time. Da da da. And then again, repeats. Da 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 da.
Excellent.
So, did you think I would be playing that out and singing it or humming it?
But just in case you hadn't thought of it yourself, I made sure to suggest it.
You wanted me to do it. Okay. So y'all got to hear it here first, okay? And I'll leave my bad, rhythm and bad singing in there. I don't mind. To give you an idea of what it sounds like, and I don't think we've heard it yet. Oh, so getting back to my first point before you said, "What does it sound like, Ginger?" Okay, well, let me show you, or let me sing it to you. Question: since you already kind of said that you agree that since we haven't heard it yet and he hasn't written it, likely hasn't, it hasn't been written or at least shared with us yet, right? And before he goes, this just hit me, before he goes back in time to try and find Brianna, he had no business writing like a thing about Roger Mack, right? Because he was never called Roger Mack.
Correct.
That I know of.
No, because he was Wakefield.
Yes. And so what that tells me is that they're giving us all kinds of signaling that if the show lasts, I can't even say, I'm not going to spoil, but if we get the seasons that we want, like all the seasons, all the books or more books, it looks like it's being written in the future of a time that he hasn't been in yet.
We shall see.
Then we get, we finally get a date. It is Hillsborough 1771. Now, we did get a date at the top of the last episode, but it was needed to set us in Scotland around the time of Culloden. So that was needed because it was so different. But this is the first time, if I'm not mistaken, in this season that we're actually getting a date or a year. Well, we're not getting a date. We're getting a year for present time.
I think the year, knowing the year, is moderately important because it is the spark of the revolution, right? So I think that giving us that date and the year puts us on track to believe that this, or not believe, I mean, we believe it, but to know that this is one of the precursors to the Revolutionary War. And we're not there yet. You know, we're a few years off, but it is definitely in the works. So it's not just minor skirmishes. It's not just people being angry. You know, it's not just unimportant skirmishes. This is a big thing.
I did like, how did you feel that they got, that they fit in Clementine?
Well, it was only fair that they did. It had to. I mean, no, they didn't have to. But that was originally at Jocasta's wedding, at her house.
Yeah,
after the
Jemmy
wedding.
Gets sick.
He was a croupie. They had him in a tent, the warm water tent. It wasn't necessary. But again, I feel like everything from the books is an Easter egg for readers, which is terrible to say. But that's, I mean, so it's like, it's nice that it still got to be there, that we got to hear him sing one last time.
One last time. So you know it's going to go there. Okay. So I'm happy about Clementine. So
can we talk about that baby?
Hold on. I wrote down, oh my God, that baby looks like Ed Spaliers. It's redonk.
Right? Oh my God. It's like every time they show that baby, I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Maybe because the baby like has aged a little more and he looks more like him now, or because it's a different angle. I don't know, but it's kind of ridiculous. Yeah. He's such a cute baby too. Or they are such cute babies.
Baby bonnet.
Yeah. That's summer. And before he leaves, he says to Jemmy, I promise I'll be back to sing for you. Well, be careful there, daddy.
I mean, it won't be the same.
No, not for a long time. Now we can actually, we're not there in the episode yet, but now we can finally talk about what the nastiness that happened to Roger. Okay, so Roger and Bree have their goodbye, and they're at the Thurston's. He was not at the Thurston's, but this is from the book. She was there, obviously, to be safe. She's there with Jemmy. And while she's there, she, at least in the book, she was painting Mrs. Thurston's portrait. And she's, the plan was to have her stay there while the fighting is going on. And then we go to the tent that Jamie and Claire are sleeping in. And we actually are given a date, even though they don't tell us. If you know Jamie's birthday, you know what day it is. So this is the day before the battle.
May 1st, right?
Yes, May 1st, 1771. And Jamie will be 50 years old.
He's 50.
Stop it.
I can kick and stretch and kick. That's an SNL reference.
Yes. He takes stock of his almost half century body. And this is also straight from the book.
Yes,
it is. I don't remember if it's the morning of the battle, before the battle. Like, I don't know if they took it from elsewhere and put it here, or if it does actually happen the morning before the battle. That part doesn't matter to me. I'm just happy that they included it. But it does make me wonder, since it's in the history books, let me go look it up, Battle of the Alamance or whatever it was. And Wikipedia should tell us the date. Oh, I mean, they're close. It wasn't that great, but it was close. May 16th. They're close. So they're being a little shoogie-woogie with the dates, but look, they got it in May. That's pretty darn good. And Claire does this taking stock as well. And she says she does it every year. She does, but at least in the book, I don't know about Claire in the show. We haven't gotten a ton of it. Claire in the book does it, as she says, for her birthdays and everything. But she also does it a lot in general. Like she, like if she's injured or she's not feeling well, she does it to take stock of what's going on. Like she imagines her organs, she imagines her blood flow, she imagines her her bones. So she's literally taking stock of like how her body is and how her health status is, not just what have I done in the last year or how am I this one more year older. I love Jamie with a little bit of scraggly hair.
And then she sings his Marilyn Monroe birthday song.
Oh yeah, yes. What did you think about Jamie with the scraggly hair, a little bit coming down out of the little ponytail?
I mean, it's just a precursor for Jamie in the river with all of his hair everywhere.
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, that's true. What I had forgotten, but we are reminded of, is that at 50, Jamie is now has lived longer than his father did. So that was sad. And as they talk of Brian, their love theme is very slowly played on a violin or a fiddle. It's very pretty. And then, as Summer said, she gives him her birthday present, doing her own version of Marilyn Monroe's Happy Birthday. Governor Tryon touts all the weaponry their side has. And we find out there are 1,068 crown and militia, so that's including Jamie's men. And there's still General Waddell's brigade to come. Jamie tells Tryon that the regulators they'll have no such weaponry. And Governor's like, too bad, so sad. Actually, it's more like the other dude who was in the red coat uniform. It wasn't. Tryon is of that opinion, but the other guy actually said it. And then Captain Mackenzie arrives. That's Roger Mack, by the way. That gun is taller than him. I was like, how awkward is it carrying that on a horse? Oh my gosh. And Jamie hands out the Fraser Militia yellow cockade. And Isaiah shows up. And the Browns remind us they're still pissed.
Yeah. And I put Browns versus Isaiah is back on. Well, technically, I put Browns versus Ooh. Nathaniel. And then I changed it to Isaiah.
Nathaniel. The mystery man. Oh, Summer. You mean Lionel? Oh, maybe that's why it's Lionel and Nathaniel. Because of the ending?
I knew it was the Browns.
That's funny. Claire defends him and saying, look, Alicia chose. You got to like, you may not like it, but your daughter or your niece's choice. Lionel Brown tells Claire to mind her own business. Oopsie. So they are, even though it's not to do with Claire, it has to do with Isaiah, all of that. They are laying the groundwork. They are laying some kind of groundwork for Lionel specifically. The Browns in general, like, are kind of, because of the whole Isaiah thing, right? They're, like, a little pissy. Understandably, but whatever. That's there. You guys knew that from the episode. There's a background there. Here we're being reminded that Lionel is now turning a little bit of that to Claire. And I get that he's upset, but is he also eternally scraggly and drunk?
She keeps getting in his way.
Yeah, she does.
He's been so close to doing what he wants to do in those multiple episodes and those arcs. He's been so close to getting his way. And then she thwarts him. Jamie thwarts him. The Frasers keep thwarting him. And he still feels slighted.
That he should be dead. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah, of course. Lionel's upset, understandably. But is he also eternally scraggly and drunk? Apparently so. He may not be drunk here, but he definitely was still scraggly. Whereas Richard still looked, you know, put together comparatively. And then there's a little scene between Jamie and the Lindsay boys. Jamie sets the Lindsay boys straight regarding war. He's like, make no mistake, war is killing. He says, you can't waver. And then they find out that General Waddell was ambushed. So it's just going to be them. They're 1038 people. No sign of Murta. And the minister, Reverend Caldwell, brings a note from the other side.
I would like to say that the two sides have a very bad method of communication with each other. Neither of them are really good communicators. Both sides. Because both sides are playing, you know, heated and hot-headed and braggadocious over what they want and what they're going to do to get it. And I'm like, nobody's listening to anybody at this point. And no good can come from this type of communication.
Yeah, it's just, it's very, it has to be frustrating for both sides, especially the dudes.
It's like they sent the first letter and he was like, ah, you're a d-. I'll see your d- and raise you my d-. And let's measure our dicks.
Oh, Lord. So the governor's like, I'll give my response by noon tomorrow. Jamie tries to calm the governor, but the governor's like, nope, we're done here.
Well, he wants to be done there, too, because he wants to finish this so that he can leave and go to New York and never have to and not have left a mess down here. So he wants to leave it settled and done so that he doesn't have to do it again later.
Or his replacement doesn't. Yeah. So back to the Thurstons. Brianna is there with Mr. and Mrs. Thurston. They speak of the battle to come, and someone, I think one of the two, mentions Alamance, and something triggers a memory in Bree, and they show her where it is on the map, and she gets more of her memory, and she's freaked out enough to leave. She rides out to the camp. She's like, I've got to warn them that this is actually it's a decisive battle.
It's the spark of the revolution.
Or at least it's an important battle. Then we go to Jamie and the blood baptism.
Well, he's not bloody at first. He's just hot. And then he cuts himself.
He is hot. Yeah. He is hot. His hair is down. It's short.
And then he's bloody hot.
And then he's bloody hot, literally. And he's not naked, though. In the book, he was naked. But also in the book, this happened at Fraser's Ridge. This didn't happen at the camp. So I get it. You got to kind of.
And this is also Scotland.
Oh.
And I think that if he was naked, he would be an innie and not an outie.
Oh, Summer. Well, they're not going to show us that.
It doesn't matter. No one would be comfortable in a river in Scotland.
He can wear some tape or like a, I don't know, like a little, whatever, G-string? I don't know what you call them. The thing to hold it in. Jockstrap. I don't know. Anyway, I'm just saying the difference. I'm not complaining. Claire stumbles upon him, but I thought, it's not her fault, but I thought, I don't know how believable that was. She's like, oh, Jamie.
She was looking for him.
I mean, she probably knew he was going down.
She was probably looking for him. She wasn't surprised to find him there.
That's what I mean. She wasn't surprised at all. So she says,
neither was I.
I forget what her question is, but his response, she must have asked about, you know, are you asking God for this or doing that? And he says, I wasn't calling on God. I was calling on Dougal Mackenzie. And he was a war chief.
Which I think is so funny. So funny given this whole episode.
I agree. So he was a war chief, and he says he taught me everything I know. As Bree arrives on a horse, obviously, we hear the first part of the Roger and Bree theme. She dismounts, yeah. And she tells them that there is a battle, and the crown wins. So, and it's the spark of the revolution. And so
she's like, I finally remember something from history class.
Yeah.
And it might help you.
And Jamie... She says, so Jamie must get a message to Murtaugh to try one more time to let them know that this is a done deal and they're going to lose. Roger offers to take the message to Murtaugh.
Offers? He didn't offer. He said he's going.
Okay, well.
He's like, it has to be me, because he said it has to be me.
That's what I'm getting at. So he says he offers to do it because he says it has to be someone. It has to be him or someone who knows about the future. And it's obviously not going to be Bree, and can't be Jamie. It's not going to be Claire. It's not going to be anyone else. So it has to be him, because Murtaugh knows about the future and everything, and or about time travel, and knows that they're travelers. And so it has to be one of the travelers. That's my point. It had to be one of the travelers. And Roger really is the only one for whom it's practical to be moving around.
Now, I think this is a flawed plan for many reasons. One, I know how this ends. And two, for everybody, because look at, okay, in the books, I know everyone hates it when I say in the books, he goes over to convince husband, Herman's husband, who is a pacifist.
Yes.
Who doesn't like war anyway. And when he hears that this is going, you know, this is going to take lives. This is not just everyone standing up and being angry at each other. He goes, I don't want to have anything to do with these men dying. And he leaves. However, you can't have that conversation with Murtaugh. Murtaugh is not a pacifist. Murta is not scared by fighting or war or being hurt or dying for his own cause. So, I mean, from the beginning, this is kind of a flawed plan.
Well, Summer, they take care of it in this episode. The course correction has been completed in this episode.
And I literally wrote that down.
Oh, you did? That's funny.
I said, the course has been corrected.
So Roger's going to be the one to take the message. Jamie gives him a yellow cockade and says to, you know, not when you're in the middle of them, but when you're back, you know, put this in your pocket. This will be, this will protect you potentially if you're crossing back over to this side, and a white handkerchief in case you get caught or something happens. If you get in trouble, you can wave it and say, you know, that you surrender or you come in peace, whatever that is. He doesn't use it carefully, and off he goes.
Yeah. It would have worked if he had not pissed that dude off.
Well,
I don't think he would have listened to a white handkerchief.
Of course he wouldn't have. He wouldn't have listened to it. We have more to tell you about that because I have definite opinions of that too. I want to talk about it, and I want to hear you go off. Won't go off. I want to hear you talking about it. So then we're with Claire. She's going through her herbal medicine cabinet, and she and Bree aren't very hopeful that Roger will be able to convince Murta. As Summer said, I don't think anyone was. Back in the regulator camp, Roger arrives, talks to, it's a night now, it's at night, talks to Murta. Murta is quite the ringleader, and Roger tells Murta that the regulators, according to history, will lose. They do lose. And Jamie says, this is the message he's conveying. Jamie says, leave now so that you can survive. And Murta doesn't know how to tell them, the regulators, to give up, and he won't do it. He just won't do it. Then back with the gov, he gives a dictée, and he's like, which is his response. He's like, I've been attentive. I've done this and I've done this. The answer is no. The fight is on unless you disperse.
I called that the bitchy letter writing section. Oh, and my autocorrect changed Morag to Nora. So I was like, who's Nora? And I was like, oh, that was Morag.
Nora is married to Nathaniel.
Right? Nora and Nathaniel.
Both ends. Murta spoke with men, but they're like, nope, they're balls to the wall. He's not going to stop them, but he did speak to them. There is no stopping them now. And Murta tells Roger, leave now. You need to leave. It's going to be not safe for you pretty soon. So Roger makes his way back. And as he does, he sees, I still think it's kind of funky town how he just notices she's there or her face, whatever. But he sees one Morag McKenzie doing her wash.
Was this the same actress?
I believe so.
Okay. I couldn't tell.
We'd have to check IMDb. So let me look. I can check real quick. Hold on. They don't have Morag. So.
Okay.
No, it's not okay.
We can check it later. I wish I hadn't said anything. Come on, let's go.
No, hold on. 507. Morag McKenzie. Alicia Welch. Alicia Welch. Now we have to go back to season 4.
Isn't it through the rabbit hole?
Down the rabbit hole. Yeah. Okay. That's episode 7. That was quite late. Yes. Okay. That's it. So let me go to full cast. Ah, same girl. Alicia Welch. Good on them. I'm glad they kept her. Okay. We're done with that. Yes, Summer, it was the same actress. Don't ask me how I know. Or ask me how I know. He sees Morag McKenzie doing the wash. He says, how are you? How are you and your family? How are your son? All that. She drops some laundry. He goes to help pick it up. And she goes to pick it up. And they knock heads. I think that's actually in the book, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. That's in the books.
And then he asks and she confirms that her husband is a regulator. And Roger's warning her, like, for all of them, like, look, you guys have to leave. There's going to be a war or there's going to be a battle and it's going to be bad. You guys have to, you know, save yourselves. And she says, we have nowhere to go. What are you talking about? And he says, look, if anything happens, your family is welcome on Fraser's Ridge. And then he hugs her.
Now, he didn't. And I was like, well, at least he didn't kiss her. But Jesus, keep your hands off other men's wives. What the hell?
Yeah, 100%. But he should have freaking kissed her. Not that we like the kiss. Not that it's not kind of stupid of him. But the kiss would have been a lot more, how do you say, inflammatory, right? A hug is enough. I agree. You shouldn't be touching other men's women. Other men's women? Other men's wives? But a kiss would have been like, seal your fate. A hug is like, really? I mean, again, the reason I'm saying that is not because I'm trying to like make it sexy time, but again, in the book, that kind of thing.
Well, I'm sure that's because the producers were like me going, why the fuck would he do that? That's stupid. Why are you going around kissing people's wives? And then they were like, yeah. well, if we leave him doing that, like the book, people might be like, well, I guess he gets what he deserves. But this way it seems much more, because let's be fair.
Less.
It's him being hanged for kissing Morag McKenzie was still an overreaction of overreactions.
Of course.
However, I think this is still, it goes to the heart of Buck's character, and he's a
Yes, he is.
So, you know, he's jealous, he's reactive, he is
hella hot.
He's a freaking McKenzie, man. Did you just say hella hot?
Yes.
You're a tool.
No, I'm honest. So,
okay.
And whom to my wondering eyes should appear but Graham McTavish, who told us he came to the premiere only to support his fellow actors?
You know what, though? They didn't show us Graham McTavish yet. They just heard his voice. So go back to the story. If you want to do this, no. If you're going to do this chronologically, like you always make me do it chronologically.
You're right. We only hear something.
His voice. The voice of a man saying, what the heck are you doing? Get your hands off my wife, or whatever he said.
Yes. And then in Tryon's camp, Jamie is yelling for Roger. And of course, he's nowhere to be seen. And the governor gifts, quote unquote, Jamie a red coat
barf.
Uniform. I mean, kind of barf. I mean, he does look good in it. Don't get me wrong. He cuts a fine
look,
form.
Look, everybody looks good in a uniform, period. I can't think of a man who doesn't look good in a uniform. Now, the issue is not so much that he doesn't look good in a uniform. The issue is what it means. And the fact that his entire life has been upended. All of his, like, so many members of his family have been murdered and killed because of the English and the redcoats and everywhere. So it's like him having to put that on and not being given a choice about it is gross. Like, that's just like, it's kind of, it's not a rape. That's too far. But I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's a defilement forcing him to fight in those colors.
Yeah. So the uniform, yeah, like Summer said, he looks good in the uniform. It's not that. But what I thought was really wow is like when he puts that tricorn on with the uniform. We really need to bring the tricorn back because it is very smexy.
I mean, it doesn't seem very
practical.
Yeah. It doesn't really shade your eyes from the sun, and it doesn't really.
No, it's true. It looks
good,
though.
Keeps your hair out of your face.
And also, imagine getting in and out of a car. It would just not you can't. You have to take it off. It's not going to work. You can't drive with it. So, yeah. So now we go back to Roger and Book. So William Buckley, or Book McKenzie, the baby. I'm saying all of this because show only watchers may not put this together with season one. If you're a book reader, you will know, hopefully. So William Buckley, or Buck McKenzie, played by Graham McTavish. He looked. I mean, Graham is already a nice looking man. Very, very good looking man. But with the hair.
Do you realize that they're doing the opposite of what they're having to do for Sam and Katrina? So they're making Sam and Katrina look older, and then they're going to spend the next however many seasons making Graham McTavish look younger?
I wouldn't say however many seasons, because Buck is in here. I don't want to give anything away, but let's just say Buck may or may not come back. But yes, if he does come back, yes, they're going to be doing it. But damn, Graham, damn, you're looking well. The dark hair. Oof.
You know, what was so funny to me was that when they first showed him, I was like, who is that? Who
who am I looking at? I was like, he kind of looks like Graham McTavish. And I was like, is that Graham McTavish? Oh my God, yep. It's Graham McTavish.
It happened that fast. And I think what the most striking, like, obviously, you know, it's a wig because he's a very not very mature, a very fine looking, mostly bald man. He's a fine man. But and so, you know, it's a wig. But like what I saw, I was like, dang, like they even did his eyebrows. Like he looks, and they did something to make him look younger. Yes. But I mean, his form, he's like, he's trim and lean, all that. He looks really good. I noticed the voice. I noticed the nose. I mean, damn, that Morag's a lucky lady. So the reason I'm, besides the whole Graham thing, we cannot really speak to the importance of Buck. But what we can say is that Buck, if you don't remember, or if you're a show only watcher, the importance of having this dude here, and we'll link it to season one. If you remember from season four, you know, on the ship, right? On the
Gloriana.
Yeah. I'm like the something Ina. No, the Gloriana. On the Gloriana, we learn from Roger that he puts it together that Morag and Jeremiah, Morag's son, are his part of his lineage or his ancestors. So he obviously wants to help anyone he can, but especially them. And he knew she was married, but they never showed us Buck, if I'm not mistaken. So Buck is his actual blood relative, not Morag, right? Buck is the baby who was given to the...
Well, no, they're both his blood relatives because he's that far down the family line.
Their baby, I understand. Their baby is his blood, but she... Yeah, okay. She is his blood as well. But as far as the Mackenzie line, it was Buck. Morag marrying into it produces, yes.
Yes, but she married Buck, but then her baby was a Mackenzie. And then she's still his great, 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 whatever, grandmother.
Yes, she's still, correct. She's still his blood. So about Buck. Buck is the baby, or when he was a baby, who was given to the parents of the foundling. This baby was Galus's and Dougal's son.
Which explains why it looks so much like Dougal.
Exactly. Exactly. This is why they didn't have to do it, but it was a really interesting choice, really cool choice. And so Buck is here. He's upset at his wife, Morag, for speaking so intimately to another man, or at least so closely. It doesn't matter that this is the man who saved her life and their child's life. Roger should not have punched him. That probably sealed his fate with Buck. But Buck also has friends. In the book, he also has two friends holding Roger on either side. And it is Buck's being rough with Morag that causes Roger to lose the rest of his marbles and punch him. The friends pick him up and they punch him. And Buck then sees the yellow cockade and Roger knows he's in trouble.
She's like, what the fuck?
And they want to kill him, and he doesn't shut up about his wife. So Roger may not have kissed her, but he can't shut up about her. So yeah, they knock him out. Back with the governor. They're prepping for battle. And Claire freaks, understandably, when she sees her husband in a red coat uniform. And I thought this was funny. I'm like, wait, are they doing the line? No. I don't know if this exact line was from the book, or if it's just a play on the line, but it kind of made me laugh. So he says to her, as before he goes off, there may come a day when you and I shall part again, but it will not be today. And I wrote, yep, cause fire. And it's kind of a sexy shot with all those dudes in uniform lined up. I know they're the crown. I know they're not on the side of whatever, but it's a nice shot. And then of course you see Jamie and all that. Claire and Brianna remind us that we are missing Roger. And then shortly into the battle, Isaiah has been hit from the back.
From behind.
And that's mentioned several times, or something alluded to several times. And that's important.
Yeah, the Browns were trying to say, oh, well, he was a coward. He was running away.
How or who would have shot him from behind?
And they were like,
Meaning it didn't come from a regulator. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just keep that in mind. And Claire uses her penicillin on a dude, and Richard Brown asks, or was it Lionel? I think it was Lionel?
Lionel.
One of the Browns,
I think,
asks Lionel. Lionel Brown asks, what is it? And she's like, oh, it's medicine. It's going to hurt it or help him. And then shortly after the conversation about Isaiah Morton, Lionel gets pissy at the where, at the where, at the way Claire speaks to him. And she's trying to say, you know, she's inferring. She is implying that, you know, maybe there was some hanky panky going on with as to who shot Isaiah and it wasn't from the other side. And Lionel gets pissy, pulls her syringe out of her hand, throws it on the ground and stomps on it.
And with that, I wrote snake needle back on the table.
It is. And I spoke with a friend. I won't out her, because I will credit that I did not have this thought myself. But I can't remember who told me. It was one of two people. And that was, he only broke the glass. He didn't break the needle. He didn't break the plunger. So if she can get some glass made, it's possible. But the point is, she doesn't have it right now. But yes, my first reaction was, we might get the snake needle. But we don't know. Then my friend was like, no, she can have it. I'm like, oh, well, you just put my hope down the drain. But we'll see. It opens up. It's anything's on the table now as far as that, as far as plungers and everything. But she still has penicillin. She just can't give it to anybody else at the battle now. And the battle winds down. It's basically done. They're dragging in some prisoners and dragging in the wounded and bringing in their own wounded. And Murtaugh has survived. And Murtaugh saves Jamie from a man named Withers, mm-hmm. who was advancing on Jamie. He was very threatening. And just as he's walking toward his godfather, Murtaugh is shot by one of the Lindsays, mm-hmm. who does exactly what Jamie had told him to. Don't waver. And he didn't.
Yep. And this is where I wrote, course corrected. And then they led to the book scene.
Yes, I called it. I'm not saying I'm the only one who called it, but I called it that they gave him his line back. What I did like, and this was new because, again, not in the book, when Jamie's like, I release you from your oath. You shouldn't be here and all of that. And he says, I'd never betray your mother, no matter who asks. That was a lovely line. It doesn't make up for Murtaugh being alive. But it was a lovely line to tie those things together. And I wrote, I was so happy that they did give him his line. And that is the same one that Jamie recalled in the books from Culloden at when he died. And that was when Murtaugh says, "Dinna be afraid, it doesn't hurt a bit to die." What did you think about all of that?
I mean, I'm glad we don't have to course correct for Murtaugh anymore. It's kind of made the show a little muddier and not as succinct as some of the, you know, books have been. So I'm kind of glad that they don't have to tiptoe around and insert him into things he doesn't belong in anymore. The only thing I don't like now is that the mourning, angry Jamie, we never had to deal with in the books, because that all happened off page. And that all happened in Ardsmuir. And because at Ardsmuir, he lost not only his godfather, but he lost his wife. He lost his baby. He lost all of his things. And then he spent the next, you know, 20 years rebuilding himself. So by the time we get them back together, he's not moody, mourny, out for revenge. You know, that part of his life has kind of passed. Whereas now, that this is going to be fresh, this is going to be all new. And this is going to be a new driving force behind choices that show Jamie is going to make, which I'm not super excited about.
Well, it's interesting you say that. And it's interesting that even though it was major course correction, which was needed, they could use it, which is what I think you're suggesting or thinking of. They can use this as fodder, as tinder for Jamie's passion in books or seasons to come. So not only is he going to be on the side of the Patriots if and when they fight in the war, all these things, because he knows from his wife and he knows from his daughter that there will be a revolution and the militia, the Americans, the Patriots win, not the crown. So he knows that when it comes to that time, he knows what side he'll be on. But now he has not just I'm going to do it because my wife was right about Culloden. My wife was right about all these things. She knows I'm going to be on that right side. But now he has a personal reason to be on that side, or another reason, I would say, not just a personal reason, not just I'm going to do it what's right. Because in the books, and they haven't done it so much in the show, we haven't gotten there yet. But in the book, there comes a time, and they talk about it, that And I think it happens in book six. I don't think it's book seven. It's book late, like really late book six. Again, we don't know what they're going to do in the show. But it's a very important time and a very important thing when Jamie stakes his sides, right? Chooses sides publicly. Because for so long, well, up till now, at least in the show, right? He's fought for the crown, on the side of the crown, not because he wanted to, but because of the whole his obligation to Tryon in the land. So once that's kind of done, he's like basically on his own, at least in his mind. His side is him and his family, right? His friends and his inhabitants of the ridge. That's his side. But at least in the book, I don't know what they're going to do in the show. Jaime, for at least a good number of years, serves on behalf of the crown as a link to the Native Americans. They call it an Indian agent. So he's still involved in that, even though he... So anyway, my point is, it's kind of he has his own side and then he has what he's doing. And he knows going forward at some point, he's going to have to publicly come out, if you will. And it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous because once he does that, any and all of his contacts that are with the crown will shun him, understandably, you know.
Well, you can't put yourself back in the closet after you've gotten out, right?
No, exactly. So that's a big time. Now, he hasn't done that. He has not done that yet because we're not close enough to to that time in history yet. But that is a huge deal in the books, as it should be, right? He wants to keep him and his family safe as long as possible because as soon, especially with his connections, as soon as he stakes his, I say claim, as soon as he lets himself out of the closet or comes out of the closet and says, no, I'm a patriot. I am for, there's another term that they use. I am for freedom. That's what he says. I am for liberty. As soon as he says, I am for liberty, that it gets all the hackles of everyone in a red coat uniform up, and he is no longer trustworthy and he has now become an enemy. So he, even though he no longer feels this obligation to Tryon for the land issue, he does still have connections with people who are with the crown. And so to protect his family and to protect his inhabitants, his residents of the ridge, he has to play, like they said, right? Like walking down two sides of the fire, or what was that episode called? He's still doing that in book six.
Walking between two fires.
Yes, he's walking between two fires in book six. So we don't know how they're going to handle that in the show, but it's very important to know that while he may be quote unquote done with Tryon now as far as his personal obligation, he has not declared for liberty yet. That does not happen for a while. If they keep it similar to the books, it does not happen for a little bit.
But he gives his coat back and tells him, we're done.
Yes.
My obligation is fulfilled. You will take nothing more from me. This is done. We're breaking up.
Yes, he breaks up with him. And then we see Claire with the body of Murtaugh, and she takes off the brooch before covering him up. Now, that was the brooch that he tried to give to Jocasta?
Wasn't it I don't think it was. Didn't he give that one to her and leave it? Didn't he have a copy?
No. Did he leave it because she gave it back?
Remember he was wearing one and then he gave her another one, I thought. But she took not just the brooch, but she also took the scrap of fabric, the tartan.
Okay. And then they're wondering, has anyone seen Captain Mackenzie?
Nope.
No? Okay, let's go look for him. And they really quickly, not like in seconds, but in less than a minute, I think, they come upon the tree and they see the three men who are hanged. Now, let me ask you this question before we talk about that. Were you not also a little bit disappointed that they didn't have Morag try and run across?
To tell them?
Yeah.
No, not really. And I think that the way that they've fashioned the discovery was more of a surprise that they find him, because they kind of walk up to the tree and it's not until they notice it's his coat that they know it's him, right? So I'm not saying one way or the other, but we may get the lead up to the hanging at the beginning of the next episode.
Oh, I am sure. I am positive we're going to get the lead up. And it probably will involve Morag, but because we already know she can't serve the same purpose in the show as she did in the book because they didn't find him the same way,
right?
Or they didn't. Yeah. So, but yeah, no, I was disappointed, not upset, just like, oh, because that was really, really, but we don't know what they're going to show her. Like, she could have been knocked out. We don't know. So we will have to see what the show is. But I am like 99.
Her husband obviously beats her. There is no way. There is no way she is going against him right now that freshly. And she probably doesn't know that he was hanged.
And he's huge compared to her. She's small. By this point, she may. We don't know. Because we don't know. We don't know. But I agree with you. I am 99%.
She's with the regulators still. They put the...
Oh, they took him to him. Yeah,
they put the little flaggy thing on. And they took him to Tryon. And Tryon and his cronies hanged him.
Yes. So I am 99.9% positive. We will get the lead up to that. Okay. So they see the three men hanged, and all we hear or learn is that Tryon ordered their execution. They were regulator prisoners. There's no Morag around.
Nope.
Yes, that's from the book, but I was just making like a list of things, what I noticed. And then they noticed that one of the men is Roger. Now, did you notice anything besides his coat about his body?
That his hand was under the like it was supposed to be.
We only see, well, let's not give that away. We only see one of his hands.
Well, you can see the one by his neck, and the other one is tied to his waist.
Yes. So you only see one of his hands out near his body. And Jamie's over there and he kind of nods to someone who's letting him down, and he holds his body as his body is coming down, and they cut it off. Well, we see Bree's face, but they cut the camera away before we actually get, and I know his head is covered with the sack, but they cut away before they even have like his head level down with Jamie's.
I couldn't believe how long it took them to try to cut him down. They stood there
100%. Me too.
Before cutting him down.
Well, yes. I agree. So something we know or believe will happen next. You'll have to wait till next episode to find out what that is. But I understand I'm like, okay, now that's a cliffhanger. People argue about what a cliffhanger is and isn't. That's a cliffhanger, because I think you know, you think you know what's happened, and then next episode we find out what really happened. We'll see the lead up. We'll find out. But anyway, yeah, it's going to be an exciting episode, and it's not going to be, I think they take a week off some.
Well, we'll see. Join us next week when we will be discussing something. We'll decide what that is, because I believe that Stars is taking the week off next week. If they don't, we'll have an episode. If not, I mean, we'll always have an episode. If not, if there is no new episode, we will have, maybe we'll have a mid-season recap where we get a couple people in. Or something else. We'll see. We have some stuff in the can we could throw together. Anyway, if you'd like to continue the conversation, join us at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And again, a special thanks to this week's co-producer, Linda Z. To find out more about what does that mean, to be a co-producer of one of our episodes, you can find out more at outlanderpod.com/Patreon. And there are still a few slots left in our Pod Abroad 2021 Outlander themed tour of Scotland. You can find the itinerary, the pricing, everything there at podabroad.com. And thank you guys, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Wash your hands.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code Outlander20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.